Hello everyone and welcome to the penultimate Autosport podcast of 2013. We've assembled another cast of reprobates to discuss the matters of the moment, and like Sebastian Vettel and those post-race donuts, we'll fly in the face of authority by doing what we want and when we want to. So joining me, your host Henry Hope Frost. Yes, I'm back after missing last month's pod and enduring a roasting from the stewards, as well as a massive fine that I'm going to put on expenses, are magazine editor Charles Bradley.
Hello.
Features editor Kevin Turner.
Hello.
And news editor Glenn Freeman.
I would love a donut right now.
You can't have one because you were horrendously late.
Apologies.
Actually, you lot look like you'd be better eating donuts than doing them anyway. Shall we start with Formula One?
Why not?
Sebastian Vettel, four championships, which was wrapped up in India, and then he blew them all away again a week later in Abu Dhabi. Glenn, people say to me all the time, oh, he's in the best car. But if that was true, Mark Webber would be winning lots of races too, wouldn't he?
Well, exactly. And you've only got to look at Mark's results in the World Championship over the years that Sebastian's been in the other car winning the championship. Mark's finished third, sixth, and he's currently fifth. So if the car's that great, you know, he should be at least second. I know there are some nuances to getting the most out of the exhaust gases for the aero and stuff like that that Sebastian's nailed and Mark's always struggled with. But if the car was that dominant, he would still be second all the time, surely.
Mm. What about the tyres? The mid-season switch, has that suddenly made a big difference to the Red Bull? Or is it all aero?
It's probably helped a little bit, but you've got to remember that unlike in 2012, where it took Red Bull a long time to get their eye in, so to speak, Vettel was ahead on the previous tyres as well. Mm. So, perhaps it was closer and Ferrari could win a couple of races and Lotus were a big threat, and they sort of still are. But Red Bull were ahead anyway, and I think would have won it anyway because they're always strong on these final tracks. So I don't think the tyres have been decisive, certainly not as decisive as someone like Fernando Alonso would like to think.
And Vettel's won championships on both tyres, hasn't he? He was already champion before Pirelli even started.
Yeah, he won on the hard Bridgestones. He mastered the Pirellis before most people in 2011. He dealt with everything that they threw at him last year, and he was dealing with the four-stop races we were complaining about earlier this year. Whatever circumstances are thrown at him, he masters them, usually quicker than anyone else as well.
Yeah, I was just going to say just recently when they went back to the more softer tyres when they used the super soft. Just recently, again, he was peerless, and you just have to say that he's just doing a better job than anyone else.
Is his dominance, I mean, what's he on now, 7 in a row and 11 for the year, I think?
Yeah.
Is it bad for Formula One? Are people going to be switching off because of this?
It's certainly bad for business, I think, at the end of the day, but everyone else has got to do the job that he's doing, and you can't hold that against him, you know, that level of dominance. It's just everybody else has got to do a better job.
Yeah, it's not his fault. He's super talented and he's sort of engineered that team and car around him, is it?
Well, it's not unusual for the best drive, the best car to win the championship. We say, oh, is he the best car? But most of the world championships since 1950 have been won by a driver in the best car. So to hold that against him is a bit harsh. I think he's definitely one of the greats. Where he slots in will be determined by what happens when he is in a car that isn't the best, and I'm sure if he hangs around long enough we'll get to see that, and I'm sure he'll come through with flying colours, but that's the only thing we haven't seen yet.
Yeah, it's always puzzled me why Vettel's so unpopular for winning all the time when Michael Schumacher was so popular for winning all the time. But I think Kev's picked up on something there. It's racing a bad car, but also racing for another team. Schumacher won a couple of championships at Benetton, went to Ferrari, and I think it was the years of the struggles and the near misses that made even Michael Schumacher seem like a bit of an underdog for a while, that probably garnered some more support for him. And Vettel has come straight in, and he had a little bit of time at Toro Rosso, but he's basically been driving top race-winning cars all the time, and for some reason that makes it difficult for people to connect with him.
I think part of the difference as well is that Schumacher was at Ferrari, which has a resonance in the sport that Red Bull just doesn't have, and that's something that doesn't matter how good a job they do, they haven't got the history. They are a fizzy drinks manufacturer, and that people hold that against them.
I've sensed a little bit of mellowing towards Vettel, though, certainly from India onwards when he did the donuts, and he sort of stuck two fingers up at the establishment a little bit when they find him. I think that's made people warm to him a little bit more, and certainly the boo seem to have stopped on the post-race podiums.
Yeah, that's true. Someone who was expected to give Vettel more of a run for his money this year, particularly after winning in Australia, was Kimi Raikkonen. The whole Raikkonen-Lotus fracas has been a bit messy, hasn't it? Is that all sorted now, Glenn, do you think?
I think it's sorted to the point that that relationship will limp to the end of the season. So I'm not sure if Davide Valsecchi will be on standby for the next two races as he was in Abu Dhabi for a little bit. But yeah, I think but Kimi is looking forward probably to seeing the back of that team and maybe getting a paycheck next year. But likewise, I mean, I'm told that the team, once they knew he was going to Ferrari, they thought, well, we don't need to put up with all the things we've been tolerating from Kimi as well now. And he, he's so popular for being his own man and doing his own thing. But, you know, there's a reason that a lot of the top drivers and everybody else sort of toe the line a lot. And it's because that tends to be the way to get the best out of yourself and the people around you. And I think, yeah, especially with Romain Grosjean coming on strong as well now, the team, I feel, are gravitating towards him a little bit. And yeah, it's just turned really sour, hasn't it, with Kimi and Lotus.
But Charles, Kimi is an employee at the end of the day, like the rest of the guys on the team, who's paid to do a job. And if he's not been paid, then why should he do it?
Yeah, if you were owed over 15 million bucks, you'd be a little bit disenchanted to do your job, wouldn't
you? Well, I am and I am, to be honest.
But, you know, you can't fault his performances this year. One of the reasons he's earned so much money is that he's on a very sort of strict, you know, pounds per points system of payment. And he's almost been a victim of his own success in a way. The fact that the number's this astronomical is because he's had such a fantastic finishing record, and the fact he's won two Grand Prix in the last two seasons. So I think that's why the number's ramped up to this big astronomical figure. But you can't knock him for, you know, trying his hardest, even from the back of the grid. You know, driving into the back of the Caterham wasn't exactly what he wanted to do, but, you know, showed he was trying.
One thing I was a bit disappointed with last weekend, you know, give the team a hard time, you know, turn up a bit late, don't speak to the media as much, all of that. It's fine, really, because that's all part of the job, and it's, you know, it's him rebelling in a little way. But I was disappointed to see a picture of him at an autograph session for the fans with his headphones in.
Yeah.
You know, Kimi doesn't talk much and probably doesn't interact with the fans much normally, but, you know, he's probably the most popular driver on the grid at the moment, and he hasn't even got the time or the willing just for, you know, for 5 minutes, just play the game with the fans. You know, that's not so much something for the team. I just thought it was really disappointing.
And that's something that would be glossed over with Kimi, whereas if Vettel did it, there'd be a massive outcry.
Yeah, or Lewis Hamilton or someone like that. It's, oh, he doesn't care. Look at him listening to his iPod or whatever. But with Kimi, I don't know. I even saw people saying, yeah, it's great to see he does what he wants. It's like, it's rude.
But Jenson Button would never do that, would he?
No.
Regardless of whether McLaren would let him or not, he just wouldn't do that, would he?
No, Jenson's, you know, he's very mature now and he plays the game. And I think he's... he's almost the sort of the prototype for how a driver can get across some personality without giving too much away.
Yeah. And he'll talk to anyone as well.
Yeah, that's right.
He comes across as a nice guy, doesn't he?
Yeah, the quantum takeover or part takeover is going through. Will that bring the right level of cash and commitment, do you think, now for Lotus?
Well, going through is the first thing I'll pick you up on, because the money was supposed to have arrived Monday night. And I spoke to a couple of our guys Tuesday night, and as of then it still hadn't arrived, so who knows, by the time this podcast comes out maybe the money has arrived, but
and
the team
all look silly.
The team,
well, it's like when you move in house, isn't it? There's always that time where the money disappears from your bank account and doesn't arrive in the other person's, and you suddenly panic, don't you? I don't think we should cast too many aspersions just yet.
Yeah, it's taken such a long time. You know, these guys, you know, they originally turned up calling themselves Infinity. Then had to change their name because Red Bull was sponsored by Infinity with an I at the end. So they've been around for ages, and they said it's banking restrictions have delayed it so far. And let's just hope that's the case, because the team is a successful team and they desperately need that investment.
Let's talk about Felipe Massa for a moment. He seems to have let the handbrake down, so to speak, since being sacked by Ferrari. Who's he trying to impress now, do we think?
I think he's off to Williams, isn't he? I think that's the favourites, the odds-on favourite at the moment. Heard there's quite a bit of money involved as well. He can bring quite a bit to the team. He's a quite clear B-grade driver, I'd say. I think that's exactly what they need to make the step up, because at the moment they're definitely a C-grade team.
Yeah.
As far as who he's trying to impress, it's the Brazilian companies that are about to sign on with Williams, I think. You know, Bruno Senna brought them a load of Brazilian sponsors last year, so it might be that they can use the Massa deal to bring some of those relationships back as well.
And we know we can't have, or we can't not have a Brazilian in Formula One. Bernie said it himself. So he'll move heaven and earth if he's as long as his current issues in the High Court don't cause him too many problems.
Yeah, I know it's been a while, hasn't it? But Felipe Massa's still, he's still an 11-time Grand Prix winner. He can take a lot of experience to a team that's perhaps sort of gone the wrong way for a bit.
He's the sort of driver they need, basically, because they need pulling up by the bootstraps. They need someone who can drive it on. He can bring a lot of ideas about how Ferrari works and what direction perhaps they should be going. Obviously, Pat Simmons has got a huge amount of ideas about how to run a team to a world championship as well, which I think they'll do well to listen to. And you could also look at his recent performances against Alonso. I think he's up to 9-8 now, just one behind Alonso in qualifying. And everyone raves about Alonso being the best driver in the world. Well, he's in danger of being out-qualified over a season by his apparent on his way out teammate.
Mm. So potentially Massa to Williams, and that's one of the sort of facets of the driver market, isn't it? Which looks like it's still all over the place. We've got uncertainty at McLaren, at Lotus, Force India, Sauber. There's lots still to fall into place. What are your feelings on that?
Well, I've got a question for Glenn. How confident do you think the chances are for Kevin Magnussen to get a McLaren next year?
They're growing by the day at the moment. Sunday morning in Abu Dhabi, internally at McLaren, the feeling was that a Perez contract extension was 99% going to happen. He then had a bit of a lacklustre race, and somebody pointed me to the fact that everything Martin Whitmarsh said post-race through official channels and interviews was always a quick line, basically slagging off Perez's job in the race, and then the rest of the time just wanted to talk about how much Jensen could have achieved if he hadn't had the incident at the start of the race. And the main pressure to take Magnussen over Perez isn't coming from the top, it's coming from the guys in the race team. They want Perez out. They're not pleased with the job he's done this year. But the main resistance to taking Magnussen and the main man trying to keep Perez is Martin Whitmarsh, because Perez was his sign-in this time last year. So I think as a matter of pride, he wants the Perez experiment to work. But yeah, there's a real growing momentum for Magnussen at the moment, and I think it'd be brilliant to see McLaren take a rookie.
Especially with the Honda thing on the horizon, it'd be great to develop a brand new rookie driver for when that comes on stream in 2015, wouldn't it? Give him a nice sort of glide path into it.
Yeah, blood him in 2014, and then he's there and ready for when Honda come in. And it could have echoes. It's obviously a very different time now, but it could have echoes of when they took Lewis Hamilton, if they do it right.
Yeah.
The amount of speed Magnussen's got, it'd be fantastic.
Or
to
even Mika Häkkinen, with Michael Andretti on his way out.
Yeah exactly. That's right.
But, I mean, with the rule change sort of reset next year with the 1.6-litre turbos, it's sort of wiping slates clean, isn't it? It's not as if sort of everyone's going to have an advantage with what's gone on before. It's all new, and so it's going to be new for Kevin as well.
Yeah, all the established drivers have got a lot to learn. It's very hard to judge what you need in 2014. Do you need someone coming in fresh who doesn't know the previous generation of cars, or do you need the experienced guys who are used to learning and developing concepts very quickly? If you're thinking with your heart rather than your head, you want to see new, quick, deserving rookies get a chance, I think.
Yeah. Talking of new, quick, deserving rookies, we've got a couple of Russian children racing next year. Daniil Kvyat at Toro Rosso and Sergei Sirotkin at Sauber. What do we think of these guys, and are they up to their neck in it?
Well, I've seen Kvyat race a lot in GP3 this year. And I've been hugely impressed by him. You know, he's a rookie into the championship this year, so a really steep learning curve. And by I'd say Valencia, he learnt it. He was there, and from there he sort of transcended that learning curve and went above it, and just totally dominated the rest of the championship, proving that you could drive at a higher level. You know, obviously Formula One's a massive step, but you can see why Red Bull has decided, you know, take his nationality out of it for a second. You could see why they've taken a flyer on him, because they think the potential's there, just like they saw in Vettel, you know, from his World Series and F3 days. And that's what they're looking for. They're looking for the next Sebastian Vettel. They're not looking for the next Sebastian Buemi or Jaime Alguersuari or whoever. They're looking for, you know, somebody who could have that ultimate potential to be right at the top.
Will he struggle without having had GP2 or Renault 3.5 experience?
It's a massive step. Fortunately, he doubled up this year and did GP3 and F3. And F3 is a great category for learning a lot about car development, and there's a lot more technical freedom, so the drivers learn a lot more there. So he's been busy, at least, and they've, but you know, he's got, what, 21, 22 laps in an F1 car to his name. And the reason, part of the reason that number is so low is because he threw it off at Silverstone when he had his first chance.
So
it's going to be a fierce learning curve. And it's the same for Sirotkin. He's had a day or two now in an old Ferrari as far as getting himself ready. But at least he's got a year of World Series by Renault under his belt. Are they ready? Probably not at that age. How can you be? But more so with Kvyat than Sirotkin. As Charles said, if the potential's there, then yeah, get him in and get him learning the right stuff as soon as you can, I guess.
I think my concern would be that they're given enough time, because you wouldn't want him to move up to F1 because he's gonna struggle with the amount of testing miles that he's not going to get, basically. And you don't want him to, because he's not going to look brilliant. And if people judge him too soon, then you know, his career could be over by the age of 20, 21, which is ridiculous. Mm. Yeah, he may well be super talented, but you've got to have seat time.
I'll bring nationality back into it now. I think clearly one of the big reasons that Red Bull chose Kvyat for that Toro Rosso drive over to Costa was the fact that he's Russian, and there's a Russian Grand Prix next year, and that's another reason why Sorokin's there. Is a reason why Petrov might suddenly reappear in one of the lesser teams too. Yeah. It's going to be a massive deal for F1. You know, the car manufacturers can't sell enough in Russia at the moment. It's a huge emerging market for them. So there's quite a lot of 6-7 figure reasons why they should take drivers from that area.
Yeah, nationality has got something to do with it. You know, the Russian government are in huge support of Formula One and want to see their drivers in there as well. And yeah, I've been told by someone very close to the Toro Rosso decision that it certainly wasn't pace that got Kvyat the drive over to Costa. I'm sure potential has got something to do with it, but I'm sure it was also timely to bring him in for the first Russian Grand Prix as well.
Mm. Okay, and breathe. Let's switch disciplines and talk about door banging, paint trading and fisticuffs. Yes, the British Touring Car Championship. Kev, you were our man in the paddock this year, except when you selfishly missed three rounds while spectating as Mrs. Kev gave birth to Miss Kev.
Yeah, I'm terribly sorry about that. But
that took three rounds.
Incredible. Yeah, it was 17 days late.
I had to do one of them.
Yeah. Your first touring car meeting since 2000, I believe.
Yeah, it was 13 years.
Since he killed Super Touring.
Was it better then?
In many ways, but not all.
Oh, very, very, very political answer. Recap on the season for us and pick out some of your highlights.
Well, I think it's, as series boss Alan Gow knows, I'm a bit of a purist, so we do sort of fall out sometimes about how the championship's going, but I thought this season was the best for some years. We had four previous champions coming in at the start, Matt Neal, Jason Plato, Gordon Shedden, obviously was the reigning champion, Colin Turkington coming back, so that was great. The quality at the front was good. The turbo boost levels, the equalisation was created less randomness at the front, which was a bit of a problem the year before. And we ended up with a new champion in a privateer car. Andrew Jordan drove a brilliant season. I think the highlight of the season was his fight with Jason Plato at Silverstone. I thought it was a great fight. It was fair. Both of them enjoyed it. And it's the sort of action that you want to see from touring cars.
Yeah. There was a great atmosphere at Brands, actually, wasn't there, ahead of race three. Was that sort of, will it rain, won't it rain? And everyone was very sort of... Everyone was very chilled about it all.
It was good. And the fans as well. You know, when I rocked up on Sunday morning, the weather was horrible. And, you know, I know, having missed those three rounds, that ITV's coverage is very good as well. But people came out to watch it live and stay to the end. And the cheer that Andrew Jordan got when he crossed the line to finish ninth and take the championship was, you know, it was just really nice to see. And, it was a good atmosphere.
Kev, you've been in a BTCC paddock a little while now. How many Cs was that?
Too many T's as well.
Yeah, you've been in that paddock a while now. How would you assess the health and the state of the championship? Because while it's not ever going to go back to the Megabucks days that Charles covered, the impression I get from the outside is that it's in pretty good health now. And as you say, the driver lineup, particularly at the front, is, I think, brilliant.
Yeah, I think people compare it to the Super Touring era, and that's a bit unfair because the Super Touring era was unusual. That is the anomaly, that you had manufacturers spending 10 million quid a season on a domestic tin top championship, and that is outrageous. And it'd be surprising if we ever got anywhere near that again. And yeah, I think these NGTC regulations that Gow brought in, perhaps they've not been quite as cheap and trouble-free as originally anticipated, but it's got the desired effect. We've had lots of different marks, and he's been very careful to try and make it so that privateer teams, you know, with no works funding, can put different manufacturers in there without manufacturer support. And we see it. We've got lots of different cars, lots of different drivers, and you've got the right people at the front. And they didn't quite get their full grid this year that they sort of talked about at the start of the year, but they're not far off. And yeah, generally, the driving standards are pretty good as well.
Yeah, the NGTC format seems to be working. I have to say, one of my highlights this year was the story, I'm sure you know it as well, about an ex-driver who had a go in one, and he came back to the pits and thought his steering was broken. so low rent are some of the parts, I hear.
Yes, there have been a few issues with the power steering in particular, and I think all the drivers that are doing it week in, week out get used to it. And yes, there was a former driver who came back and yeah, made that comment. And others did agree once that point was raised. But they tend to say, yeah, but we're so used to it now that we didn't notice. It's only when someone raises the issue or someone comes in from another category and they suddenly go, But if it's the same for everyone. So
that's true, yeah.
I think when you've got parts breaking and putting cars out, that's a problem. But I think if it's just that makes things a bit awkward, then no, I think that's fair enough, really.
I'll just dig Kev out of the hole that Glenn dug for him. For me, obviously covering that race at Silverstone this year was first in a long time. It was the only thing I think it needs is a couple of international level drivers, really. I think it just misses a Fabrizio Giovinardi, Alain Menu, or a Van Muller, basically. If it gets one or three of those back, I think it will take that next level step and come, you know, a national level championship that people around the world talk about rather than just a national level championship.
Yeah, I mean, that would definitely help. Although I think Colin coming back, because obviously he's a Brit, but that helped that.
Yeah.
But it's funny how many people do know what's going on British touring cars around the world. You think it's domestic series, but people do know. I mean, Nick Tandy did a test for Motorbase, and he couldn't believe the amount of people that came up to him completely separate to that, because he's a GT driver and knew about it. You know, it's easy to underestimate how many people are interested in touring cars.
Wondered how long it would be before he'd mention.
Yeah, I had to get mentioned Nick in there also.
Tell us a little bit about this license clamping down, where people can't sort of chop and change willy nilly, because there've been lots of guys who've just appeared out of nowhere. It's presumably Alan Gow's attempt to sort of tighten it up a bit.
I think that he's probably, I mean, I'm sure he has several things on his mind when he does it. I think the two main targets are, one, if you're entering the championship, you do all the rounds. You can't just take an entry place. Because at the start of this year, we had a full entry, but not a single round did we have a full grid.
No.
And I think Alan wants the entry list to look more like the grid. And the other one is, I think he wants to stop musical chairs in some of the teams. I think it's fairly obvious that, you know, Tony Gillam's team, Team Hard, did put an awful lot of different drivers with varying levels of experience in the cars. And I think Alan's probably thought that's a little bit too much and he'd like to see more regular names in the cars.
Okay, good stuff. Anything exciting ahead of 2014 for BTCC?
I think it should be more of the same, hopefully. You know, we've got five champions on the grid. You know, if they all come back, which they should do, and hopefully Motorbase will be there. A bit more on the pace. They had a bit of a difficult start to the year. So, it should be. They're talking about reducing the boost that they can give the teams again, which would be good. But, yeah, it should be more of the same.
I think you had 11 different models of car this year, and next year you've got a Mercedes coming onto the grid as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Adam Morgan, who's one of the stars of the season. You know, his rookie season last year, he was quick, but hit pretty much everything, whether stationary or another car. And he came into this year wanting to prove that he wasn't a crash, and he did. He had 26 points finishes, and he was quite often the best of the rest behind the big teams.
Mm. Okay, as it's nearly the end of the season, we've got to mention the annual extravaganza that is the Autosport Awards. This year, Charles, fans can vote for their favourite drivers and cars online. How does that all work?
Yeah, we changed it around a little bit just to try and get the... obviously, on our website, we've got great reach worldwide, and it's great to get as much input as we can into it. So for each category, 6 nominations, vote for whichever one's your favourite, have your say, and then we'll make sure that your vote counts, and we'll be... And that driver will be crowned on December the 1st in London in our glittering awards ceremony.
For one young wannabe, of course, the Autosport Awards culminates in his winning the prestigious McLaren Autosport BRDC Award, which includes, of course, £1,000? No, it's £100,000. We've gone a little bit low rent. £10 this year in prize money and a test in a McLaren F1 car. Kevin, you're on the judging panel for that. When you look at what people like David Coulthard, Jenson Button, Paul de Resta, Dario Franchitti, Anthony Davidson et al. Have done, it's still a massively important accolade, isn't it?
Absolutely, and for me, it's a huge privilege to be involved, because it is, I think we all, as fans or journalists, kind of, one of your things you're interested in is to try and find who's doing the best job, and with different teams, different cars, that's sometimes quite tricky to do. You know, we were just talking about, you know, Vettel, how much is him, how much is the car, but this is as close to a fair, even, you know, level playing field as you could ever get, really. We've got the six young guys out at the same time in their own F2 car. Jonathan Palmer brought out the F2 cars from Mothballs to help us out this year. We had a DTM Mercedes and two McLaren GT cars, and we just give them the same, you know, the same tyre runs, the same number of laps, and let them go at it, really.
Standards high?
Yeah, yeah, surprisingly.
They always
so,
are, aren't
actually.
They?
Yeah,
there's a reason why these six guys have been earmarked as good.
Yes, they're not chosen at random. You know, most of them have either won championships or got very near to winning them. And I think, you know, Derek Warwick, you know, who's the chairman of the judges, and he's really passionate, and obviously president of the BRDC, who are big supporters of the award as well. You know, he's really motivated and pushes on with all the young drivers. I think he's always impressed by, you know, day one morning, they all go out in the F2 cars, and it's quite impressive. And, you know, in the past, we've had benchmark drivers that have been struggled to keep up with the quickest of the finalists, which, if you think about it, is pretty unbelievable, really. Mm.
Quick word about the six from this year: Jack Aitken, Jake Hughes, Chris Middlehurst, Seb Morris, Matt Parry, and Charlie Robertson. Are you confident that six are the best six that there could be?
Yes, I think so. I think it's probably worth talking about Dan Kamish, because lots of people have talked about him as he should have been in the six, but he was too old. So that's, I can get that out there.
Yeah.
That he was too old to be. And also, he's explicitly said, I want to be a touring car driver, because he realised he's not going to make Formula 1. The award is to try and find a Formula 1 driver. So beyond that, yes, I think, you know, I think they were a good six, and it was been incredibly close. I think it's fair to say, I think I can say that five of them topped one of the sessions during the 2 days. And it's going to be one hell of an argument to decide the winner, I think.
Yeah.
Kev, tell us a little bit about how the days actually unfold, because it's not like the guys are just getting five lap prize drive runs in these cars, is it? They're getting proper you know, session time, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. This year they were all allowed sighting laps in a McLaren before 12C road car, which for two of the drivers was pretty interesting because they didn't have road licences. One of them had never driven a road car, so their first road car drive was with a 625 brake horsepower supercar, which Andrew Cocodi, who's one of the judges and provided the cars, wasn't too keen on that beforehand, but it's too late, he'd already committed to it. So they do that, and then they each get their own F2 car with their own F2 engineer, and they have one session where they have to go out and they basically can do, I think it's a 40-minute session, and they're not allowed to change the car, so it's just to get used to it. And then they have a debrief session with their engineer, what can they improve, look at the telemetry, and go back out. And again, they can't change the car. And then the third session is new tyres, go for qualifying lap. And, you know, obviously every racing driver knows what qualifying lap is, so that's where they sort of hang it out. And then this year in the afternoon, we put, obviously we only got the two GT cars and the one DTM, so we put them through there. And again, they have the same number of runs, so they all got a run, two runs on old tyres and a run on new. And then the following day, which this year was in the wet rather than the dry, so we got to see them in two different types of conditions. We did the same again with the F2, but with boost. Mm. So the very last run in the F2 car is a full-on qualifying lap, new tyres, boost, which is what you would have had when F2 was a championship. So it's lots of different things to throw at them over the 2 days.
Kev, am I right in thinking that since we've been using the F2 cars, that's created a sort of unique opportunity where you actually get everyone on track at the same time? Does that help the judging process?
Absolutely. I mean, before, when we only had, say, two cars out, so two F3 cars, you would sort of try, if your two drivers are emerging, then you try and fudge it so they were out at the same time, and then you could make a call. But if you couldn't do that, then comparing, especially, you know, November, conditions are very rarely consistent, so you then have to talk to the engineers, you have to get the benchmark driver out, who got closest, and it's sort of always second guessing, whereas if you stick them all out at the same time, then obviously you take out a lot of those variables, and it's a proper session. Mm. They're all fighting at the same time, so yes, it does make judging an awful lot easier, but this year the drivers have managed to make it difficult by each having good and not so good sessions during the 2 days.
That must have been good, watching them go around in Rolt Hondas and March BMWs and Tolman Harts. And
we did one year when
hang on.
Sorry. The other F2. They're quite serious as well, you know.
Yes, yeah. They are. One year, actually, when we looked like we were going to lose one of the cars, Marcus Pye, who was a judge at the time, did suggest we bring out some F5000 loaders to put them in, which,
wow,
which would have been absolutely fantastic. But Yes, oh. I think that might not have been appropriate.
And before it gets all horribly, historically dribbly and nasty, we should end. Thanks for that mostly insightful insight, chaps. Your jobs are safe for now. Thanks to you too for listening. We'll be back in December. And that's a donut. Autosport.com. All the news first.